There's a kind of startling unity of the meanings of all these texts, that even the Psalm. Namely, they point to the Jews, when they worked at their best, understanding that what they were about was to precisely detribalize the world. And that was to be done only, of course, because there was one God who was the God of everybody. So Isaiah says, my house is going to be a house of prayer for everyone. All the nations, we're told in the Psalm, are going to praise God. And of course, as you know, the Jews divided the world up into Jews and Gentiles. There were Jews and there were people who were non-Jews. But everybody is supposed to be unified. And Paul, in this astonishing middle section of the letter to the Romans, is talking about how the Jews who did not accept Jesus' resurrection were going to be unified with all these pagans who did, and the rest of the Jews who did. And finally, this lovely thing from Matthew. Wherein in the Gospel, Matthew has Jesus saying, I'm only for the Jews, first of all. And yet Jesus, in the Matthean reading, of course, talks to this pagan and heals this pagan lady, and that's accomplishing what Jesus as a Jew and the whole Jewish thing was to be about. We're perilously close to the platitudinous, I think, in talking this way. But it seems to me, even at my advancing age, that this has become a more and more crucial issue, and one that we're it seems to me also clear that it's the one problem in the world that we are least successful in dealing with. How do we detribalize the world? This lovely saying, I love humanity, it's just people I can't stand, is really illuminating, I think, and points to a central problem here. How do you start doing this? You start loving everybody and then sort of under that rubric pick out particulars that you like. Now, I suspect both psychologically as well as logically and chronologically, it works precisely the other way. You begin looking carefully at the human beings with whom you are most immediately connected, and out of that comes an honest attempt to embrace the world. So today I just have a couple little suggestions for myself, first of all, and I hope they're useful for you too, as to what goes into this this connecting to the immediate world. And of course the Gospel offers all kinds of indications. I think one of the most important ones is this theme that we find every place. Don't judge people. And of course we have to be really careful here, because often enough that's been read as the 11th commandment, thou shalt not be offensive. You know, that's not what it's about at all. When Jesus talks about judging people, he's talking about judging their motives and condemning them on that basis. He says that's what you can't do. Not only can't you do, but you shouldn't do it either. For the simple reason that none of us knows her own motivations fully in doing anything. You know, we glide through life. We were part of this great cosmic machine, you know, of supply and demand, and the invisible hand of the market, and you know, the regulations of the university, and the penal code, and traffic violations, and all of that. And then we just kind of manage to fit into that great machine. And it is very easy because so much of our world convinces us that's who we are and where we are and how we are to be, that this business of judging is not attended to, and so we do it kind of automatically by inattention, I think. I think that's the way it works. We may see ourselves, in other words, as flowing nicely through life, doing all the things that a good North American citizen is supposed to do, and then in quite in passing and quite accidentally living this inner life whereby we just simply dismiss all kinds of people. So that's one problem, and a very large one. Maybe the largest one, I don't know, given our culture. Because in third world cultures, of course, you can't do that. You don't have all these wonderful distractions. You don't have all this vaunted efficiency, you know, to enable you to function in that way. Life, which I believe is essentially messy, is much more obviously, evidently messy in the third world than it is for us. We got computers. We got the internet. Tidy, 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 tidy. Okay, so that's a problem, or a major problem, as to how that transforms our interiors. But there's, I think, an even more pernicious result of that, and that's what I'd like to just say a little bit about. This has to do with the business of giving advice. I take it as a given, there's nothing so useless, in fact harmful, as unasked for advice in the world. It's really nasty, because if you don't want to hear what anyone wants to say anyway, and then somebody says, well, what you really need, I mean, your problem is, I mean, that just aggravates things and creates more layers of impenetrability between people so nobody can talk to anybody. But look at the business of giving advice, which we do, I think, there's either more of this going on or I'm becoming more sensitive to it or more guilty of it. But we do that with astonishing ease, I think. The problem is the same problem as this problem of judging. Do I know that other one enough, well enough, to be able to say anything that is going to be in any way helpful? And of course, advice, if it's misdirected, simply muddies the waters of one's life. That's point one. Point two, if it's not asked for, it becomes an obstruction, both to the person to whom you're trying to advise and to your relationship with that other one. Well, what it boils down to, I think, is something that is, again, constant all through the Scriptures, the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, too, that the other is the mysterious other. The other is truly other. The other is not an extension of me. It is not me externalized or writ large. And how often our advice and our judgment makes that presupposition unconscious. The other is the other. The other is the hidden other, the mysterious other. And it would seem on the face of it that should be a kind of spontaneous acknowledgement, because if we step outside of our social roles and our functioning in that great smooth geometry of the modern world, then we know we are mysteries to ourselves as well. Well, it doesn't take a great leap of imagination to go from there to an acknowledgement of the mysteriousness of that other who is not I. And the stakes are not just psychological harmony, you know, or social amelioration. The stakes are the stakes all through the scriptural text. The stakes are, what is going to enable us to really love? universally. So that's what this whole business of detribalization is about, and is where it's supposed to end. How do I come to love? If I don't love the other precisely in their otherness, then I'm no place. Now that assumes, and I unhappily do not make that assumption very well or very effectively, most of the time, that I simply make space for the other. I don't start giving advice. I don't start limiting the shape of their life. I give them space in my life. I give them space to be in my life. And out of that space, some kind of connection becomes possible. But without that space, no kind of connection other than a purely mechanical one becomes possible at all. So I hope this is useful, underlying this, you know, this nice Canaanite lady and Isaiah talking about the Lord's house being a house of prayer, and Paul trying to do this terrible job of reconciling the non-Jesus Jews with the Jesus Jews and the pagans. Because it is, I find it salutary, at least, to remind myself as regularly as I can that that's what this whole enterprise is supposed to be all about.